I'm Warren Smith, and today you'll be listening in on my conversation with Clarissa Moll as we discuss her late husband Rob Moll's book, The Art of Dying.
Acknowledging our mortality makes a difference in how we live. It makes a difference in how we die. It makes a difference in how we grieve, how the people who are left behind make sense of death, of loss.
Clarissa Moll has been on a journey none of us wants to take, but in all likelihood, almost all of us will. And that is the journey of walking through a season of mourning the loss of someone close to us. In Clarissa's case, it was her husband, Rob Moll. Rob was a well-known and well-respected journalist in the Christian world. He had served as an editor of Christianity Today, a communications officer at World Vision, and director of business operations at Eventide Asset Management, an organization that invests money according to biblical principles. Rob, Clarissa, and their children were on vacation in the Pacific Northwest when Rob died in a hiking accident in 2019 at the age of 41. That part of the story alone is poignant enough. What adds extra elements of irony and wonder is the fact that Rob, even as a young man, had made a study of death and had thought deeply and wisely about how Christians should face death and how we should help each other face death as well. His book, The Art of Dying, was published to critical acclaim in 2010 when Rob was barely 30 years old. Now, that book has been republished with an afterword by Clarissa Moll, who is a fine writer herself. In fact, her work has appeared in Modern Loss, Practical Homeschooling, The Gospel Coalition, and Christianity Today. Clarissa, first of all, welcome to the program. It's great to be with you. And I want to start our conversation with just kind of a basic question that you may be the world's leading expert in, which is, can you tell me about Rob?
You know, Warren, thank you so much for having me. That is my bar none favorite question in the entire world. I love to talk about Rob. Rob and I were married for 17 years. We had four children together, and our life was full of adventure and a lot of mundane too. Rob and I met at the singles table at a wedding, which was before, you know, online dating and that sort of thing. We did it old style, and we enjoyed life together. He worked for Christianity Today and World Vision. And so we moved around a bit for his work. And his life was always characterized by words. Rob was a man of words, and he wrote a lot, and I edited beside him. We were a good team together. And Rob loved adventure. He was not a risk taker, but he loved to be outdoors. And that was something that as a couple, as a family, we just really wanted to invest in. And so on our family vacation in 2019, Rob decided to take a long ridgeline hike in Mount Rainier National Park. That was kind of the capstone of our vacation together. And he didn't call me when he was supposed to get back to the trailhead that day. And he'd never done that before, but he was conscientious, he was skilled. And so I tried to kind of tamp down the anxiety that started to build a little bit. You know, I'm sure he's fine. I'm sure he's fine. But as the time ticked on, I connected with friends. Has anybody heard anything? And it was all radio silence until a white SUV pulled up to my campsite and delivered me the news that honestly, no one ever wants to hear, that Rob had fallen to his death in Mount Rainier National Park, that he had died in that fall and he was not coming home to my four children and me. It was news that shattered my life and changed it forever.
Well, yeah, I can't imagine. It's a story that you retell beautifully in the afterword of Rob's book. And what you've said brings up so many questions, but you mentioned that you are a writer yourself and an editor, and you and Rob were a good team. I can't help but believe, though, that this might have been the hardest writing assignment that anyone would ever have in their life, to write something like you wrote. I mean, have I got that right? Was it as hard as I imagine it must have been, or was it something that you really wanted and needed to say?
Well, you know, author Megan Devine says, write to leave yourself a map. And honestly, as I've talked to other grieving people, writing has become a source of comfort for them. So even though it's hard to put those words down, to say those things that honestly are mind-blowing, that you don't even want to believe yourself, let alone make them concrete in words on paper. Even though it's really hard, I think for many grieving people, writing or artistic endeavors allow them an outlet that gives them space to explore all of the emotions that come with grief. And it gives them an opportunity to love their person. And I found that the writing assignment to write the afterword for The Art of Dying was just that kind of process. Mm. It was both incredibly difficult, but also what I consider to be like my last love gift to Rob, to be able to see our words together on the page, to let the world know how much I loved him and what it means to me now that he's gone.
Well, you know, it is ironic. I mean, I think everybody that knew Rob or even heard about his death, because of course it was reported pretty widely in both in the local media, but also in the national Christian media as well, that Rob had died, I think age 41, is that accurate?
That's right.
And you know, after having written a book about dying called The Art of Dying, I mean, I don't want to be glib about this, Clarissa, but there is something almost poetic about that in a way. And we're going to talk about that book in just a few minutes. But I want to, again, kind of stay in that moment of, you know, right after Rob's death, and just ask you, what did you learn during that year that maybe wasn't in Rob's book, even though he did such a beautiful job of researching and a diligent job of doing original reporting? What did you learn that you wished you could say? And also a kind of a related question, what did people say to you that was helpful and unhelpful during that time?
Well, when I think about what I learned, boy, I feel like I could hear Rob slapping the table in glory and laughing to hear me say, he was right. You know, doesn't every husband wish that his wife,
I guess so. Yeah, I guess that's right.
But Rob was right. Thinking about death in advance makes a difference. Acknowledging our mortality makes a difference. It makes a difference in how we live. It makes a difference in how we die. It makes a difference in how we grieve, how the people who are left behind make sense of death, of loss. And so I think over the first year that I lived after Rob died, there were many times where I thought to myself, honey, you were right. All those times I didn't want to talk about this subject and you pressed into it. Every time that you encouraged me to think about what our life would be like if one of us were gone and I wanted to plug my ears, I'm glad he did it. I'm glad that he leaned into that really difficult subject, because I don't think anything can prepare you for grief. There's nothing that can prepare your heart for the magnitude of what it feels like to lose a person that you love, the radical reorientation that happens after loss. But I think you can prepare yourself to meet death, to face death. And so even though, you know, I don't think our conversations prepared me for grief, I think they certainly prepared me well for death. That said, I'm a young widow. I've got four young children. I'm sort of the black sheep in the grieving community. When I tried to join a support group, a woman mentioned, you know, most folks are going to be about 20 years older than you are. And I thought, I'm not sure I belong there. And I found after losing Rob that there were many spaces where it felt like I no longer belonged. And that was a real struggle for me. And I think because of that, few people said anything. You talk about things being unhelpful. I didn't really receive many pat answers. I know a lot of grieving people do, and those are deeply wounding. But I think people were flabbergasted. they didn't know what to do with me. And therefore, they couldn't say things like, well, he's not in pain anymore, or at least he's with the Lord. You know, the things that we say a lot of times when we have someone who is elderly, who has passed away, or someone who's had a terminal illness, where we see them languishing and fading. Nobody could say those words to me. And honestly, I find that that was actually a gift because I was spared some of the difficult things that people often say to grieving people. And I ended up being the recipient of a lot of beautiful care. People who just, I call it fumbling toward love, because they just kind of started doing things like, can I bring you a meal? Or can I pick your kids up from this place? Or can I take them to baseball? And honestly, those are the kinds of gifts of presence that are the real balm for grieving people anyways.
Yeah, well, you know, this, in some ways, what you've said also kind of falls into the category of Rob was right all along, because I, when you were saying that people didn't know what to do with you, Rob actually quotes C.S. Lewis in this book. From, I think it was when C.S. Lewis wrote A Grief Observed, but Rob quotes it here. He says that Lewis wrote that this was after his wife had died. Lewis said, I find that I am an embarrassment to my friends, that they just kind of don't know what to say or do with me. And that's Rob put it in the book. And that's exactly what you experienced, it sounds like.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, C.S. Lewis goes further to say that when he walked across campus, he felt like people shied away from him because they were worried, almost like he was infectious, like he was a leper. He says in A Grief Observed that maybe grieving people should be gathered together in a sort of leper colony where they can just kind of take care of each other's wounds, because everybody else feels like, oh, this is going to happen to me if they get too close. And I think tragic loss has that that feeling that goes along with it, that there's sort of a space in a crowd that's created when I walk into a room. Oh, you know, I sure hope that never happens to me. You know, that runs through people's heads. And honestly, I hope it doesn't either. But wishing those things away doesn't make us more articulate at engaging with them when inevitably they do cross our path.
You're listening in on my conversation with Clarissa Maul. We're discussing her late husband's 2010 book, The Art of Dying, which has been republished by InterVarsity Press with an afterword by Clarissa herself. I'm Warren Smith, and we'll have more with Clarissa Maul after this short break. Welcome back to the program. I'm Warren Smith, and you're listening in on my conversation with Clarissa Maul. We're talking about her late husband, Rob Maul, and his 2010 book, The Art of Dying, which has just been re-released with a new afterword by Clarissa. Let's get right back to our conversation. Clarissa, I'd like to pivot in our conversation just a bit, because, you know, we mostly in the first segment we're talking about, you know, kind of Rob and your experience here and following his death and the writing of the afterword for this book. But I want to dig into the book itself a little bit, because you know, Rob has some really great practical advice about what to do, and I want to get to that. But I want to begin with sort of the state of death and dying in this country, even in the church, which Rob describes as probably not optimal, not, you know, altogether healthy, that in the culture at large throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century, we have put death away. We've professionalized it, we might say. And as a consequence of that, we don't know how to deal with death and with dying people anymore. Can you say a little bit more about that idea? And also, we can transition into what Rob says in the book we should do about it.
Sure. Well, you know, very few deaths happen at home anymore. You know, that was a tradition for hundreds of years. Let's be honest, centuries, right? And it doesn't happen that way anymore. Most of the time, death comes in a hospital or some kind of hospice facility. It happens with medical professionals around and very few family members. It doesn't happen in the space of community. And because of that, we have become inarticulate about what it means to care for grieving people and what it looks like to die. And we see this in the church as well. You know, it spills over into our worship. It spills over into our church life. Churches build themselves as uplifting and encouraging worship. And that leaves very little space for people who are carrying a heavy weight of grief, whether you're a full-time caregiver for someone with dementia, or you're suffering a sudden loss, whether you have experienced a miscarriage in your marriage. Uplifting and encouraging just doesn't cut it when you are really, really hurting. And you know, go ahead.
Well, yeah, no, I just want to interrupt. And I don't want to wander too far afield from that. But, you know, in some ways, sort of our evangelical, you know, culture where we've got a lot of age segregation, you know, that this church has a contemporary worship style, so everybody that's young is going there. Well, where are the old people? You look around the church and you just don't see old people often, or you go to a different kind of church, maybe a more traditional church, and you see all old people and you never see young people in that church. I remember going to a church probably about 20 years ago that had been around. It was a church plant that had been around for 20 years at that time. The pastor told me that they had never done a funeral in that church, a church that was 20 years old that had never done a funeral. And that was when the light bulb kind of went off for me. It sounds like that's what you're describing as well.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, we need intergenerational churches. We need young people who don't have that fully developed frontal lobe. We need them attending funerals of elderly people who are wise, who have given their lives to the church, to the community. We need that cross pollination of wisdom to happen, because without it, we have folks who grow up with a lack of understanding about what it means to live faithfully as a Christian when you're aging, when your body's falling apart. We become prey to all of our culture's lies about chasing youth, about defying death, and honestly, a large dissatisfaction with our limitations. And Rob and I always sought out multi-generational churches, intergenerational worship, because we wanted our children to have more than two sets of grandparents. We wanted them to have grandparents who were sitting in the pews with them every Sunday, as well as their family of origin grandparents as well.
Well, Clarissa, so that's what's wrong with the culture and even in the church. But there are antidotes to that. There are solutions. Rob, in the book, talks a good bit about a good death, and he talks about a Christian death, how Christians and how the church should approach death. Can you say a few words about those ideas and kind of unpack them a little bit and say why they're so important?
Sure. Well, I think that there are two spheres. It's helpful to think about this in two spheres. It's the personal and then there's the communal, right? So Rob talks about the personal reckoning that each of us has to do with our mortality. When we acknowledge our aging process, when we acknowledge our frailty, our fragility as we get older, we can bring those things to God in ways that allow us to accept our destiny as humans. And he talks about Martin Luther's sermon on preparing to die, where Martin Luther goes through encouraging a friend, hey, you know what? You don't need to be afraid of dying. You can reckon with God. You can keep short accounts. You can do the things that you need to do personally to be ready when your hour comes. So I think there are things that we can do to be ready personally. I think that communally, we can do things as well. You know, a lot of people choose hospice as a last ditch option when hospice offers so much more. Rob was a hospice volunteer, and he would often come home from training saying, I wish people joined hospice sooner, that they could have the months of care that these wise, honestly, midwives almost would offer. People who were conversant and very comfortable in helping people meet their ends well. So that's just a practical piece of it. But engaging with a community that is willing to talk about death, whether it's hospice, joining a Sunday school class that offers an education, a conversation about death and dying in the context of faith. These are all things that we can do to make it easier to take away death's taboo status and honestly be more ready to meet our own ends and care for others around us as they meet theirs.
Well, one of the things that is a kind of a recurring theme of the book is that even for those of us who are not imminently facing death or don't know that they're imminently facing death, because in fact, you know, we could all be facing death at any moment, is to have these conversations with people you love, prepare, you know, maybe that might include life insurance, that might include a will, that might include end of life instructions. Though you wrote, Clarissa, the afterword of the book, you are actually a recurring character throughout the book. And as Rob, you know, describes events that he went through often with you, for example, early in the book, there was a visit that you and Rob had with his aunt, I think it was his aunt, Eileen, right?
That's right.
But one of the other, and he revisits that conversation later in the book. But I want to ask about a particular conversation that I want your take on. A couple of years ago, I interviewed a woman named Kara Tippetts, who some of our listeners might remember. She ultimately died of cancer. And I interviewed her at her home when she knew she was dying of cancer. She knew that she was probably within a year of dying. And in fact, she died much less than a year later. Her husband was in the room when Kara said to me, "I want Jason to remarry whenever I'm gone." And Jason, I mean, he did not want to have that. It was clear, it was obvious to me, even though Kara was very comfortable saying it out loud, that Jason was very, very uncomfortable having that conversation. Maybe it was because I was there. Maybe it was in front of me. But you and Rob had to have a similar conversation. Tell me how that went.
It did not go well. I'll be honest. I didn't want to have any conversation around remarriage. I mean, he was going to be around forever. There was no way that was even relevant to the conversation. And he pushed for even that. And, you know, he documents, I think it's page 85 or 86 in the book, where we had that conversation and really hashed it out, because he had strong feelings about what I should do if he were to die young and our children were still young. He felt our kids needed a dad. And I thought nothing could ever replace him. And, you know, grief is an expression of love. And I want to hold space for that, because there was a time when conversations like this were very different, when women and men were encouraged to remarry quickly because of cultural expectations or honestly necessity. And that's changed a lot now. And so I think couples have these kind of conversations now because they can, because the choices that we make after our loved one passes away really have become choices. We're not cornered in most cases about what we're going to do with relationships or career-wise, even where we live. Many folks break that, don't make the big decisions in the first year after loss. They break that rule and they sell their house and move. I did that in the first year after I lost Rob. So those kind of things are, I feel like a luxury, a privilege to be able to have a conversation like that with your spouse in advance, because even as difficult as it is, it allows each person to articulate their love in very meaningful ways. Mm. And it releases you to live after your person dies. And for me, really, that's been the bigger theme that Rob writes in his book. I know that she will make good decisions if I am not able to be by her side. And boy, I just take that as a talisman. That is his promise to me. And when I am filled with self-doubt about decisions that I have to make now as a solo parent, as a single woman, I think he trusted me. He said I could do this. And it gives me freedom and also a lot of encouragement and strength to now build a new life without him.
You're listening in on my conversation with Clarissa Maul, who wrote the afterword to an expanded edition of her late husband Rob Maul's book, The Art of Dying. I'm Warren Smith. A few final thoughts from Clarissa Mall and a few thoughts of my own after this short break. Welcome back. You're listening in on my interview with Clarissa Mall. Let's get right back to that conversation. Clarissa, I'd like to kind of come down to earth in the last segment that we're together. Not that we haven't been before. I know this has been very real and very practical stuff so far, and I appreciate you being so transparent and forthcoming with your story. But you mentioned in the last segment that, you know, Rob told you before he died that he trusted you. He knew you would make the right decision, and that was, having heard those words, was important to you. I want to kind of talk a little bit more about some other things that are important for us to say and do, both for and to each other, but also as we maybe get ready for the end of life. One of the things that Rob says in the book, and I'd like for you to comment on, said that there are four things that a dying person needs to hear. I think my recollection is that Rob wrote this in the context of, well, I don't know what to say when I go see a dying person, right? And Rob just said, well, listen, when in doubt, there are four things that a dying person needs to hear. One is, please forgive me. The other is, I forgive you. The other is, thank you. And the fourth is, I love you. And I really experienced that as a gift. I mean, it kind of showed me, oh, if I don't know what to say, I can try one or all of those. I mean, can you say more about that?
Yeah, you know, we should stick those on a little card and laminate it. Keep it in your wallet, because those are important things to say to a person if you're not sure what to say, honestly, in any context, whether the person is dying or not. And, you know, I think that it gives us words to say when we are fumbling around and we want to be present, but we're not sure how. It keeps us from saying something trite and something that's unhelpful. But I think also, and this has been a gift to me, because I never got to say goodbye to Rob. Rob left our campsite in the morning and kissed me goodbye. I said, have fun. And those were my last words. Have fun? Who says have fun as their last words to their person? But I think about that now, and I think, if I want to feel a sense of peace or completion, I can still say those four things now to him. Hmm. You know, I think a lot of people who are grieving deal with regret after their person dies. They think of all the things that were left unsaid, the things they can't undo. And I love Rob's four phrases, because they can bring peace now. If you weren't able to say goodbye to your person because they were a continent away when they died, if your person wasn't conscious, you know, if you had someone who was on life support and you never got to say those words, you can sit in the quiet of your own car or your own bedroom and just have that inner conversation. Say, I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? I love you. You can say those things. And I honestly think that it can bring peace. Mm. It doesn't complete that relationship because you can't hear their words to you, but I think it offers your soul something that you need as well.
Well, you know, Clarissa, just for the record here, whenever I read your final words to Rob, have fun, my heart leaped. I thought that was a beautiful thing to say. I mean, maybe it would have been cool if you could have said, I love you or I forgive you or whatever, but have fun is not the worst thing you could have said to. You know, I think about the Westminster Catechism. What's the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. If that ain't fun, I don't know what would be, right? So
there you go. Yeah.
So, well, okay. Coming back, I'm sorry. I just couldn't resist putting that in there, though. A couple of other kind of real practical things that are in the book that I'd like for you to unpack a little bit. One was just about the funeral itself. Rob talked about this funeral home, which I guess was near where you guys lived at one point, a Hultgren funeral home, where a lot of the staff there had seminary degrees. And it was a kind of a different approach to kind of the industry that death has become. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, the guys at Hultgren were an amazing team of gentlemen who worked together to reshape what it looked like to die Christianly. Rob began working for them, and he worked the night shift. And so he would take calls in the evening, and he would connect with the guys as they were headed home or headed out to pick up a body. And it was, you know, when I think about it, that seems like the creepiest time of night to work at a funeral home, or time of day to work at a funeral home. But Rob found it really peaceful. And I think it was because of the atmosphere that they cultivated, that death was something for a Christian that need not be feared, that we could walk beside each other as we faced this hard thing, and that we could do it well and in ways that offered people lasting comfort more than simply just a balm or Band-Aid at the time of the funeral, but continuing care afterwards.
Mm, yeah. Well, any other practical suggestions, Clarissa, that you would want to share with our listeners about that, you know, might be approaching the death of a loved one themselves or want to prepare their own lives and hearts and minds for the good death, for dying in a way that glorifies God?
Well, the one thing that Rob said that was more valuable than anything else was the gift of presence. If you couldn't get the words out to say his four phrases, if you didn't feel like you were an adequate cook to bring a casserole, you could show up. And showing up was all that was really needed. And when I think about how people can attend to those they love who are dying, that's the one gift that everyone needs. Everyone needs to feel as though they're not alone, because death is scary. Even though we know that Jesus has conquered death, that it's lost its sting because of his resurrection, we still live very much in that messy middle, the now and not yet. Mm-hmm. And so the gift of presence reminds a person in their dying days and hours, months, honestly, that they haven't been abandoned, that Jesus walks with them. And most often that happens. Grace looks like people when you're dying, when you're grieving. It looks like people showing up and doing practical care, cleaning your bathrooms, getting you groceries. It looks like someone sitting beside your bed, maybe without anything to say, but simply a hand on your arm to let you know you're not alone. Mm. And if there were anything that someone could offer someone who is dying or grieving, I think, again, Rob was right. It's the gift of presence. Those things right. matter.
Yeah. Well, finally, Clarissa, I just wanted to ask, how are you doing now? How are things going?
I'm doing well. I'm doing really well. And I think when I say that, I don't want to gloss over the fact that life without Rob is hard. And I think it always will be hard, because there's not a day that will go by that I don't miss his presence. But God is good. God is faithful. He provides. And I am convinced that there's flourishing after loss, and I'm headed for it. Mm.
That brings to a close my conversation with Clarissa Mall. She wrote the afterword for an expanded edition of her husband Rob's 2010 book, The Art of Dying. I hope you'll indulge me a quick story before we go. The last time I saw Rob Mall was in Washington, D.C. I was between meetings on Capitol Hill and was catching up on emails at a coffee shop called Ebenezer's, which is my favorite spot to hang out on the Senate side of Capitol Hill. I looked up from my computer screen and I saw Rob rushing down the sidewalk from the direction of the Capitol towards the Washington, D.C. office of World Vision, where he was working at the time. But I honestly didn't really believe my eyes, because Rob spent most of his time at World Vision's headquarters in Seattle, and I live in Charlotte. It was truly a random, or we might say providential, event that would have put us both in D.C. at the same time. So by the time I collected my wits and decided it really was Rob, he was gone. I quickly emailed him a short question. Rob, are you in D.C.? And he responded back, yes. We exchanged a couple more emails that day, trying to find a time when we could get together for a coffee or maybe a meal, but alas, it was not to be. I think about that strange final exchange often. It would have been fun to get together. Rob was intelligent, full of life and energy, and someone you could go deep with, even if it had been months or even years since the last time you had talked. We were not close friends, but I always thought that someday we might be, and I mourn that lost opportunity. But Rob, in that experience, was also a teacher, and it has motivated me on more than one occasion to pick up a phone and call someone I haven't spoken to in a while. Rob called us to cultivate a habit of being that took death into account. He called that habit of being, that awareness, living in the light of death. Rob closed his book with these words, "In the end, death is as mysterious to us as resurrection. In our churches, we spiritually enter into Christ's death and resurrection in the waters of baptism. In the same way, we must practice for our deaths. Prepare to care for others as they face it, and look for the hand of God who welcomes us through death to life everlasting." Today's program is our last listening in before the summer break. I hope you've enjoyed this spring season's worth of programs as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. If you're new to the program, I hope you'll spend the summer exploring our archives. This is our 8th year of doing in-depth interviews like the one you heard today with Clarissa Mall. And that means we have more than 450 such conversations with musicians, filmmakers, politicians, writers, culture shapers, thought leaders, newsmakers, just all kinds of folks. The best way to find those interviews is simply to go to the World News Group website, WNG.org, and use the search engine at the top of the page. Listening In comes to you from World News Group. Your membership in World News Group helps to support this program as well as World's other digital and print content. To find out more about becoming a member of World, go to getworldnow.com. The producer for today's program is Johnny Franklin. He gets technical support from Carl Peets and Kristen Flavin. Our executive producer is Nick Eicher. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and you've been listening in.